This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Let's do a box office top 10. Here we go. I mean, we've mentioned a couple of the big movies of the week, but some other reviews to come, yep, including probably the movie of the week at a minute to four. So yes, let's do a box office top 10. You've seen almost all of these.
Yeah, the thing I haven't seen is Three Idiots. So other than that, I think I've seen them all.
Planet 51, number 10.
She's perfectly fine. I like the design of it. It has a kind of nostalgic retro feel. Nothing extraordinary, but, you know, pretty good.
Twilight Saga New Moon, yes, is at number 9.
Yeah, and I may be mistaken, but I think Mr. Aguirre's, who was the DP on The Road, also shot New Moon, as a bit of trivia. I like New Moon. I mean, I know that some people have been slightly down on it. I really like it. I'm really looking forward to the next one. The books have been devoured in our house, and I think it's, you know, a good and interesting story, and I like it.
We had Nowhere Boy at number 8.
Which is the story of the early life of John Lennon, which is it's a peculiar film. There are things about it that are, I think, you know, are very admirable. It's attempting to do something, you know, with a part of the story of John Lennon that we don't know before. I think it does it rather well. I think the difficulty is that in terms of John Lennon portrayals on screen, Ian Hart was so great in that he sort of embodied the danger of that character so much that it's hard, I think, for anybody else to step up to that mark. That said, it's very well put together. I like Sam Taylor Wood's short film, Love You More, very much. In fact, to some extent, I could have done with slightly more of the experimentation of Love You More in Nowhere Boy. But it's a good, solid, you know, early music life biopic with a couple of fine performances in it. And it does include that line in it in which somebody says, we're going to form a band, but none of us can play. That's all right, it's a skiffle band. And
excellent. Everyone applauds.
There's also a line there which somebody says that the skiffle, the washboard player is leaving because he's basically not getting enough girls. And can I just say, not true. I've known some washboard players in my time and they have all been eminently romanceable.
Three Idiots at 7.
I haven't seen it, as I said at the beginning.
Just say something about it.
If you've seen it, text us and let us know.
That'll do. Centrinians 2, The Legend of Fritton's Gold.
Which I've now seen twice. Because the choice was, because, you know, I was trying over Christmas to go and see film, take the family to see films. My son wanted to see Avatar. My daughter wanted to see Centurion's Gold. So I've now seen Centurion's Fritton's Gold twice. I've now seen it twice. Second time around, I laughed a little bit more. It is an infinitely superior movie to the first Centurion's because it is actually playing to the audience that it's designed to be playing for. It doesn't have that uncomfortable, leery quality. And also, David Tennant is funny in it. I mean, it's rubbish, but, you know.
9 at 5.
Yeah. You see, the funny thing about 9 is, were you a fan of Chicago?
The musical?
Yeah, no, not the... No, The Place.
Okay. Yeah, The Place is, yeah. The Place is really
about,
nice.
What do you think about the musical that's directed by the same guy who made 9?
I don't really like musicals.
Okay. Where do you stand on All That Jazz?
Don't really like musicals very much, but Chicago was okay. You know,
no, but All That Jazz is a specific question.
Do you like All That Jazz?
But do you like All That Jazz? Have you seen All That Jazz?
I think
with Roy
I
Scheider. It's Showtime. Okay, the problem with 9 is that it isn't All That Jazz.
Just say it's Showtime again and wave your
it's
hands in
Showtime.
An Al Jolson style.
Thank you.
Live streaming.
Yeah, it's Showtime. All That Jazz is a brilliant example of what you can do with a musical about somebody falling apart mentally, having a kind of crisis. And Roy Scheider is absolutely brilliant. It's fantastic.
Neil Diamond's in it, I remember.
All That Jazz. Oh, no, he's in the Jazz Singer. He's in the remake of the Jazz Singer. Sorry, I momentarily blanked you there. As far as 9's concerned, the funny thing about it for me is that it's a, you know, it's basically a musical invention kind of inspired by, you know, Fellini, inspired by 8.5. And I interviewed Daniel Day-Lewis, who I like very much. I think the film's flimsy. And Daniel Day-Lewis said, you know, that he did all this research for the role and, you know, he learned to speak Italian, which he speaks properly, and he did all this stuff, which is funny because he still comes on and goes, "Hey, I am Italiano. Hey, I have a shota. Yes, hello. Hey, la, 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 la." It's funny because I could have done that without any of the research.
Did you hear about The Morgans at 4?
Went to see this again because it was out, and people had said terrible things about it, but I went, and because it was a PG certificate film, I took the kids. And it's, you know, it's Hugh Grant and Sarah Jessica Parker, and it's not terrible. I mean, it's not any good. They have to go on a witness protection scheme off into the middle of nowhere, and they're in the process of breaking up. I think they are actually technically divorced, and yet they're thrown back together again because they witness a crime at the beginning, and then they have to kick around in this sort of outback area where they discover that, in fact, they do rather like each other. And Hugh Grant literally does the Hugh Grant performance, which is he walks along as if he's got slightly damp pants on. He walks like that slightly, and he does that kind of, like, he's not quite, he doesn't want to put his arms down, like his arms don't quite fit his body, and then he and he does the Prince Charles thing, and it's funny because it's almost as if that's
Sorry,
what
that
they
was
did
Prince, that was Prince Charles
but it's got to go with the walk, and the walk, it's really odd, and I actually became quite interested in the walk during the film. I was thinking maybe that's how Hugh Grant gets into character. He stands slightly legs apart, and it's as if like he's wearing a slightly wet nappy, and he puts his arms slightly, don't say that, and he puts his arms out as if, you know, when you just put antiperspirant on, you walk with your arms out for it to dry for a little while, and then he walks around like that and goes I. But it's not bad.
A treat for our online viewers. Down from number one, this week's number three is Alvin and the Chipmunks,
the Squeakquel.
I have a handwritten review handed to me
this
morning, actually. I think it was really funny, but the first one was funnier. The man I went to see it with disagreed, I think.
Go on, explain.
Okay, it's written by my son Joe,
who I took,
age 10, who you took to the cinema.
Who I think the word you're missing there is who I heroically took to the cinema.
Yes, along
to
with
the Alvin and the Chipmunks, along with the Squeakquel. It's not as funny as the first
Uncle, Mad Uncle Mark.
Mad Uncle Mark. It's not as funny as the first Alvin and the Chipmunks movie.
So you,
it's not terrible. Yeah, I agree with Joe. Yeah, that's a perfectly good assessment.
Sherlock Holmes at two.
It's the Guy Ritchie film it's okay to like. Let's welcome home. Let's big arms. Let's all give Guy a hug. It's the least Guy Ritchie-ish Guy Ritchie film he has ever made. And I understand that it bears only passing resemblance to its literary sources, and I have read a couple of things by people who know a lot about Sherlock Holmes, you know, literary origin, who are frankly outraged. But as a piece of work, as a piece of cinema, a piece of entertaining cinema, it is essentially about it's about a bickering couple, right? One of whom is really brilliant but annoying, the other of whom is not quite so brilliant but really likable. I don't know why it was that appealed to me, but and they just have a go at each other
with big hands,
and they just have a go at each other. Jude Law and Robert Downey Jr. are the reason that the film works. I mean, it's also that. No, that's not the only reason. It also looks
rather
good.
Can I just say, I'm happy to be Jude Law.
Are you? I'm happy to be Robert. And it looks quite good. It's got a kind of Hammer gothic feel to it. And far less of those visual tics that have made Guy Ritchie's film so annoying in the past. Because of its period setting, it doesn't have, you know, the geezery excesses. It's like somebody said to him, look, you've just, you know, gun for heart, you've got to make a proper movie, you've got to stop making Guy Ritchie films, and you've got to demonstrate what, you know, that you're a filmmaker. And I enjoyed it. I would quite happily see it again, in fact. It's a good, fun film.
Now, so Avatar's back at number one. Now, a couple of emails about Avatar. Dear Stavros and Davros, this is Aaron Wedgbury from Prague. I think that means we've got at least two listeners in the Czech Republic.
Very good.
I think it's Peter Smith who's our other Czech Republic. This is another one. Aaron, thanks for the email. It says, I went to see Avatar last night. I had to write to say how much I enjoyed the film. In fact, I positively bounced out of the cinema afterwards, beaming with pleasure and furiously texting family and friends back home to say, if you haven't seen the film, go see it. Simply put, it was a visual feast, beautifully made with every frame of the jungle, handled with love and a wonderful attention for detail. It was so lifelike that, being afraid of heights, my stomach lurched as the camera panned over the shoulders of the main characters as they ran across the high branches of trees. I disliked all the characters I was supposed to dislike and loved all the characters you were supposed to love, none of them eventually being human. At no stage did any of the effect, animation, CGI, or whatever it was used to stop the flow of the film, and the music simply supported and didn't intrude. Take note, Doctor Who, says Aaron. I haven't heard the Good Doctor's review of the film yet. I will hunt it down when I've sent this email. But I did hear in your end-of-year roundup that he thought it was too long.
It is too long.
I couldn't disagree more. For the same reason that I sat riveted to each of the three-hour Lord of the Rings films, I sat absorbed with Avatar, letting it wash over me, quickly dismissing any ropey plot lines and just going with it, willing the human sequences to hurry up so that we could get back to the jungle. Pure escapism, loved it, will definitely see it again, thrilled that this was the first film I've seen of the year.
Can I just, the thing I have to say on Avatar is this, I mean, I did do the review before and I said I liked it much more than I thought. It is long, it is baggy, it is, you know, overwritten, it is clunkily acted, but wow, the visuals really are extraordinary. You are involved in that world, and I think that it's much better than I thought, you know, much better than I thought it was going to be. As you know, as of 5 days ago, it's fourth biggest selling movie of all time, probably second biggest selling movie of all time by now. Titanic still the first biggest selling movie of all time. Titanic still pants. But
Mr. Cameron clearly knows a thing or two.
Oh yeah, he does. Yeah, but I think that Smurfahontas is a better film than we had a right to expect. But on the subject of the 3D, the immersion in the visuals is nothing to do with 3D. It's to do with the fact that the visuals themselves are, you know, it's extraordinary technical work. It is well done. You're immersed in that world, not because of 3D. And I have to show you this, which is my favourite Christmas present. Okay, this you
more
see this?
Even than the stylophone.
Yeah, the stylophone, but this, right? This is given to me by a guy called Simon Miller. You see these? You see what they are?
Well, they look like 3D, look like 3D films, glasses. Elvis Costello,
yeah,
style.
Okay, and they say on the side of them, Kermode 2D specials. This is a pair of glasses that my friend Simon Miller made specially for me that rectify 3D films back into 2D.
What a
he
weirdo.
Took a pair of two pairs of 3D glasses, took the left eyes out of one of them, the right eyes out of the other one, to create two pairs of glasses that will rectify a 3D film back into 2D.
So how are you seeing me and Justine at the moment then?
In lovely, ordinary flat screen. When I take them off, obviously you're all pointy-pointy. The pointy birds are pointy-pointy. The only thing it can't solve is the 30% colour loss, which no glasses can solve yet. But this, what a wonderful... The next time I go see a 3D film, I'm going to watch it
on that subject,
in 2D.
Ted Blades, listening in St. John's in Newfoundland. Dear Sinbad and Cyclops, I know I'm a bit late entering the debate here, but I've only just seen Avatar, and I'm afraid the Dear Doctor is being willfully blind to the charms of its 3D-ness. I too took my glasses off during the movie, and it didn't look or feel the same. It was a different viewing experience, and it worked for me, my beautiful wife, and our 13-year-old son. Not the obvious story arc, not clunky script, not, and absolutely not the excruciating Basil exposition narration. It was the feeling that I was actually in the film, especially in the getting chased around the jungle scenes. That the movie was happening around me. The whole point of Avatar was that it is in 3D.
No.
That was the only reason to be there. Please don't interrupt my email, says Ted. Though I would have that Mark, the consummate cinephile, would have enjoyed the sheer moviosity of it, I would have thought. Avatar, like Titanic before it, was about the art and act of movie making. That the numerous visual references to other films made me smile. Open your mind and your eyes, Doctor. 3D may not be the salvation of cinema, but it may be more than a scam too.
My favourite line in Titanic still, the moment in Titanic when I give up, is the moment when Leonardo DiCaprio says to Kate Winslet, "This is where we met." It's like, no, really?
Yeah, you are willfully blind to the...
No, I'm not.
There are lots of people who actually, I think, would agree with that, that actually you do feel that you have been on the planet.
Yes, but you feel that when you see it in 2D. It's not to do with the 3D. It's to do with the fact that it's an immersive film with some extraordinary visuals in it and the sound system is great.
Your mind
is closed.
It's not
to do with 3D. I'm wearing the 2D glasses from now on.
Some movies to discuss. And also some tunes to play. All will be explained in just a second.
Space Oddity.
Exactly! Exactly! And that's what he plays it on.
Space Oddity on a stylophone.
There he goes, there he goes.
Yeah. Do, 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 Bob spots do. The hits.
Well done.
Rob Allen in Sleaford in Lincolnshire. Dear Lewis and Morse, can you thank the good doctor for cheering up my six-month-old Jake, who since watching you online has done nothing else but try to hit the laptop while screeching merrily. It's the big wavy hands. Hello to Isaac Sheen, Morrissey, Convention and Fry.
And Fry.
And Happy New Year to them. On the subject of depressing films, this is because John Hilker earlier was saying there is no such thing as a depressing film. Stephen New Malden. There is such a thing as a depressing film, but John Hilke is absolutely right. A depressing film is a bad film. Mm. Compare Fish Tank with The Road. One is thoroughly depressing, about an unloved teenager on a council estate. It lacks any intimacy. I ended up not caring about the lead character despite an extremely strong performance. The Road, on the other hand, deals in the ultimate depressing scenario, the end of the world, but the intimacy with which it explores a father and son's relationship lifts it to a level of near euphoria as it dissects the strength of the human spirit. Why do we care so passionately about the man and the boy? Because it's anything but a depressing film. It's the best movie I've seen for years.
I'd like to leap to Fish Tank's defence and say that I didn't find Fish Tank depressing.
Pat Corbishley, dear both, the family, minus me, watched Million Dollar Baby, and although they all thought it was a wonderful film, they were totally depressed at the end. Ben in Lincoln, dear Waldorf and Statler, I'm normally a podcaster, but I decided to tune into the live show on the webcam today. The first thing I see is Dr. K playing Jaws on the stylophone. Needless to say, I've just recovered from laughing. If possible, could I request Jurassic Park or Back to the Future?
I can't think of Jurassic Park. Back to the Future, what is that? Is that
Huey Lewis in the News?
Oh, hang on.
Is
that's the power thinking? Of loving. Hang on. Okay, hang on. Let's have a go. The power of love. is a curious thing.
You're singing one tune and playing another.
No, that's how it goes. Actually, it's probably lower than that. Hang on.
It's all right, don't worry.
No, hang on.
Oh, okay. Can you get Kermode to play Telstar by the Tornadoes?
Yeah.
Just managed to see the film Telstar. Thought it was brilliant with a fantastic performance by Con O'Neill, and I'm very looking forward to Andy Serkis' portrayal of Andy Dury. So Telstar by the Tornadoes.
I'm going to have to turn it up.
I could get into this music radio thing.
There's more. Unfortunately. Oi, don't forget to tip your waitress. Thanks, I'm here all week.
I think you could do the first skiffle plus stylophone band ever.
It's a wonderful thing, isn't it?
James saying, dear Blackadder, can I request Mark perform the theme tune to Zombie Flesh Eaters, which I believe was originally performed on the stylophone.
Was it?
No, you can't do that.
No, but I can probably do it. Well, it will have been. It's the goblins, isn't it? Is that? No, that's not them. It's. I tell you what, I can do Halloween.
Okay. But somehow not scary the way you've played.
No, maybe not.
David Tooting, how about I says, dear Doctor, Mr. Mayo and Tiny Hands, can Mark play the theme to Pelham 1-2-3?
Oh, no. Not in a million years can I play the theme to the Pelham 1-2-3. Because that's a great big kind of, you know, it's a romping. No, I can't do that.
Enough
I can do
already.
This. Hang on. This is Star Wars.
I think there's a whole album of hits to be made here.
It's great, isn't it?
So we've done two of the big movies, which are clearly The Road and Sex, Drugs and Rock and Roll. Johnny Hillcoat, thanks for coming in. Andy Serkis, always great to see Andy. So what else is out that
it's
we
complicated.
Might be interested in?
The latest from Nancy Myers, who directed Something's Gotta Give and Holiday and things like that. Anyway, so it's already up for... I think she's nominated for a Golden Globe, and I think Muriel Strepsil is also nominated for a Golden Globe.
Hi, I'm Meryl Streep.
Hello, I'm... Yeah, have we got that? We should have that as a card. Hello, I'm
a
Meryl Streep.
What's a card?
Well, that's what they used to. Well, when the last time I was DJing, it was a cart was a thing that you had a bit of tape on that you put it in, and it went. Hi, I'm Meryl Streep. A cartridge, yeah. So the story is Meryl Streep is a divorcee who was married to Alec Baldwin. He has now divorced her and has married a younger woman. There's a little bit of business about the fact that the younger woman then left Alec Baldwin, went off, got pregnant by somebody else, came back to have the kid with Alec Baldwin. Now, Alec Baldwin and Muriel Strepsil find themselves falling into love or bed again together and having an affair. Here's a clip.
Why haven't you returned any of my calls or emails?
Jake, come on. This is just too weird. We have to just never do what we did ever again. You're an adulterer and I am an awful person, basically. I haven't slept in days. What we did was so wrong. On so many levels.
And it was so right on a couple of levels, too. Admit it.
No, it wasn't. On no levels was it right.
You can't say we didn't enjoy each other's company. Sitting at the bar, dancing, after dancing. Come on. You and I haven't had fun like that in 100 years.
Yes, because we're not supposed to have fun like that. We are divorced.
See... In Something's Gotta Give, there was that very good gag when, because it's Diane Keaton and Jack Nicholson, and Jack Nicholson says, what are we going to do about birth control? And Diane Keaton says, the menopause. So in terms of the things that are good about It's Complicated, is that, you know, she seems to have sort of cornered the market in the idea of, you know, older people, and I say this certainly as a man who's approaching 50, older people, you know, can still be, you know, funky and have, you know, active lives in all ways, and that obviously is a good thing. The problem is that I don't believe in any of these people or their lives whatsoever. So the Muriel Strepsil character, she works, apparently, And we know that she works because every now and then she is seen doing a little bit of cooking. And at one point she's seen doing some gardening, although it looks like she spent 4 hours in the makeup tent before going out to the garden. And in fact, they all look unfeasibly glamorous, even in the moments when they're doing the thing stuff about, oh, look how bad I look, because the gag is, you know, we're all past our prime, everything's sagged, but you know what, still, you know, we can all be sort of, you know, sexy and exciting, can't we? Alec Baldwin does a lot of stuff about the fact that he's fat. He walks around in his boxer shorts, and he's got, you know, a quite impressive gut, although frankly I can't talk. But they still look essentially like movie stars, and they appear to be living movie star lives, and they have long lunches together in very expensive hotels, and they, you know, they book into restaurants willy-nilly, and they have the most annoying grown-up children you have ever come across in your life. So there is
why are they annoying? I can't believe grown-up children could possibly be annoying, but
why is that?
I just can't imagine that.
Well, because they're just incredibly grating and irritating and exist only in the kind of movies that are made in which everybody has, you know, always got a, you know, perfect hairdo and oh, it's really, you know, it's difficult, I'm late for lunch, that sort of thing. And the biggest problem for me about the movie, however, except, you know, all those other things that are wrong with it, is it's the Meryl Streep performance that is Meryl Streep doing comedy. Now, I like Meryl Streep enough. You know, I think Meryl Streep has done some fine stuff in her time, and she's in Mamma Mia, which, as we all know, is a complete car crash of a film, but is, you know, is kind of entertaining. But she's developed this thing. You remember when Meryl Streep started out, and it was Deer Hunter, and it was Sophie's Choice, and, I mean, there was a story that was told about her by Hector Babenco, who said that when she was in Ironweed, she method acted being dead. Because there was a point in the film in which she had to be dead, right? So what she did was she came in to the room hours before anybody else, and she lay down on the floor and methoded herself into death. And then everyone came and set the lights up around her, and then they did the scene around her, and then everyone went away, and then she came out of the thing. And Hector Babenco said, "Now that's what I call acting." You know, she was the Robert De Niro of her gender in terms of, and yet, as has he done, she's moved in later life into comedy performances. But Meryl Streep's comedy performances are an odd thing, and in this movie she does the default Meryl Streep comedy, which is, what's funny is my face, well, not my face being Meryl's face, will do every emotion in about 3 or 4 seconds, as if I'm on a permanent, I can't quite decide whether I'm happy or sad. Because what she's trying to show you is that she's conflicted. So it means, ha 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 ha. So every line goes like that, and then goes down there, and then goes up like that. And, goes, how are you? And so somebody says, for example, how are you doing? And the answer to the question is, how are you doing? How am I doing? How am I? Well, I asked you, the way I'm doing is, and then we're and it's really odd. It's like watching somebody being controlled by a kid with a remote control going, happy, sad, happy, sad. Remember that thing that kids used to do on a video cam, you know, happy, sad, happy, sad, but it's like that, but without the hands. And after a while it becomes quite tiring. She'd be lying in bed with Alec Baldwin, and Alec Baldwin will be doing the Alec Baldwin performance, which is, you know, I'm corpulent but I'm still Alec Baldwin, and Meryl Streep will be going, oh, it's really good. It's really quite off-putting. And after a while, it started to grate, and I got fed up.
Could it possibly be as grating as that way you acted it out yourself, with a big, fat, kind of almost semi-pornographic Alec Baldwin lying out?
Well, Meryl's response to that question would be, well, and like that, it's really
odd. It's like a Punch and Judy character.
I know, that's what it's like. It's like going for, in one sentence, it's
that's
like going,
the way to do it.
You know, oh yes, he's great. And in here, this is, it's like her face is experimenting with emotions.
Remind me about Hector Babenco.
Hector Babenco, well, Ironweed, of course, the thing he's most famous for. And he made Pichot.
What?
Pichot. Pixote to you. Now, hang on. See if you can get this.
Breaking showbiz news, Max Beasley is going to be on with Richard on Monday, first of the Richard Bacon programme, one of the many new programmes from the BBC on Monday. What's this now?
What is it?
He'll come to me on the occasion of my daughter's wedding.
Oh, come on.
Can you put the padding in the cheeks? Just to puff yourself out a little bit more. A bit of Marlon Brando.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, I was just saying. Philip Bunting in Chicago. I'm listening online from Chicago whilst working from home. During Dr. K's rendition of Telstar, my dad popped his head into the office and said, "You're listening to Telstar?" Clearly, Dr. K has many talents, as I cannot view the live stream video. I cannot determine whether that includes ridiculously large clown hands. Enjoyed Sherlock Holmes during my trip home, but prefer to pay for my movies with dollars. Dear Waffle and Waffer, Watching the show on the web for the first time, I'm amazed that a fellow with such big hands can so effectively play the stylophone.
Boom.
He actually has got a larger stylophone. It's been specially enlarged, hasn't it, to cope with the enormous elephantine hands with which you're blessed. What's next?
That was coming. Okay, well, Exam and Daybreakers, I both want to mention. Which one should we
do? Is that a double bill?
Yeah, well, let's do Daybreakers first in that case. Daybreakers, which is his modern vampire movie. Vampires everywhere. You know, last year it was like, you know, Thirst, Korean vampires, New Moon, celibate vampires, Cirque du Freak, you know, young vampires. Now, Daybreakers. Daybreakers has an interesting twist, which is that in the near future, there's a little kind of montage at the beginning, which is a series of very nicely introduced news stories that sort of says it all began with a single bat bite. Anyway, whatever's happened, society has all turned into everyone's turned into vampires, okay? The society has been
everybody.
Over. Yeah, pretty much everybody's become vampires.
Who hasn't?
Well, exactly. There are a few people who haven't, and the few people who haven't constitute the only remaining food. The problem is that as everyone... Because that's the thing with vampires. Vampires bite people. People turn into vampires.
Is there a reason why these people haven't been bitten yet?
Because they're being used for food. Because they need... Here's a clip, it'll explain everything.
Okay, good.
Death row inmate 4705B was a vampire selected for a month-long study on the effects of blood deprivation. First signs of physical deformities began with elongated ears. Mental functions such as logic, emotion, most parts of speech, then terminated. Gentlemen, we are starving. And our latest statistics show that less than 5% of the human population remain.
If a blood substitute is not found immediately, this will happen to all of us.
We must commence testing the blood substitute.
All right, now, Private, you may feel a slight increase in body temperature. That's just a hemicillin entering your system. It's to be expected.
Yes, sir.
6-degree increase?
All right, that's slightly more accelerated than anticipated, but you're fine.
Okay, how do you feel?
Of course, he feels very bad, and then it all goes scanners. Now, interesting thing about the film is, firstly, it's directed by the Spierig brothers, who made Undead before, and this is a major step up from that. It's quite good on the vampire society, the idea that, you know, you've got yuppie vampires and business vampires and ordinary commuter vampires. There's one great scene on a subway station in which the vampires are going to what used to be a coffee stall, but is now a coffee and blood stall, when they're only allowed to sell 20% blood, and somebody's demanding more blood in his coffee. I mean, it's got those details done rather
fair
nice.
Fair trade blood.
Yes, exactly. Yes, you know, you're ethically farmed. And it's also got underlying it, I suppose, if you want to see this, a kind of a vegetarian story, because it's a story about, you know, people as food. And it's also a story about underclass, because what happens is if you're being a vampire, if you don't have blood, you turn into some kind of degenerate form, which actually becomes more and more bat-like. But it's also about, you know, people who are society's underclass. There's a drug addiction thing going on. So there's a lot of things going on in it. I mean, it is a B-movie, and it's not without flaws. It is rather sort of clunking occasionally. But it's a nice idea. It's a deal I haven't seen done before. I'm sure Kim Newman has seen it done before, but I haven't seen it done before. And I thought it was rather well done. But here's the most interesting thing. It's a 15 certificate film. And it is one of those, blimey, 15-year-olds today don't know they're born, because it's been cut by 6 seconds by the BBFC to get an 18. I'm not entirely sure what the six were. I went to the website, and it just said that they had made a few changes in order to secure a 15 certificate. But it's pretty high up on the 15 certificate. It's got
you don't know what was in that 6 seconds.
I don't, and I'm not sure whether it was.
A screening of that 6 seconds.
Well, it says it contains it's past 15 for strong, gory, and bloody violence, and blimey, child. Also includes strong language and the brief scene of female nudity. I'm not entirely sure. They may have been darkening. They may have darkened some of the scenes up. I mean, certainly the version that I saw, I thought, you know, God, if I was a 15-year-old, I'd think that my ship had really arrived, because in terms of gore, it does. There is one sequence in it involving a lift and a chair and a person, which reminded me of that kind of climactic scene from Day of the Dead, which I'm sure you know well. The zombies descend upon the I remember when Day of the Dead came out, everybody said a feast of horror, and there are moments in this in which you get that same feasting sense. So it's not bad. Ethan Hawke's quite good, and it's got Willem Dafoe, who obviously is in Antichrist. It's got Sam Neill, who of course starred in Andrzej Żuławski's Possession, which is clearly the film that Lars von Trier was trying to remake with Antichrist, and it was it really not bad at all. I mean, not great.
Was Hector Babenko involved in that?
He wasn't. No, he was asked. But he was busy with making a new Muriel Strepsil film.
This from Dan O'Sullivan in Plymouth. Dear Hoon and Hewitt, I've just returned from watching Daybreakers at my local popcorn carpeted multiplex. Having been briefed by a friend that this film was I Am Legend without the good bits, it was with a sense of familiar and wearisome trepidation that I took my seat. However, And to my complete surprise, I was thoroughly entertained throughout. Solid acting, stylish directing, some excellent facial hair on the part of the Green Goblin, an interesting take on a familiar subject. Sam Neill is menacing as the uber baddie vampire
daddy.
He's
always menacing, though. He's great.
Although I will forever associate his round face with Jurassic. That's not scary. That just looks like a six-foot turkey park. His performance kept my mind from wandering back to that dinosaur-filled island. My friend, however, is convinced that Sam Neill is, in fact, Hugo Weaving, which I'm sure he is not. But anyway.
No, he's not.
Thank you. Daybreakers is an excellent attempt to put a different spin on the vampire apocalypse film genre. That word again. Any similarities with the aforementioned I Am Legend are harsh, as this film not only was more interesting, better directed, but the special effects punch far above their weight when you consider that it cost $21 million to make. I Am Legend cost $150 million. This film makes me wonder why films cost so much to make, Avatar being a special case, when they can be accomplished so well for so little money. Little-known directors are making great blockbuster films for little or nothing, and with most people nowadays having less money than the wide awake mice, cheap production may well be the future. Throwing money at a film doesn't always make for a better spectacle. Bay, Bruckheimer and co, beware.
Well, on that note, can we move swiftly to Exam in that case? Now, we did sort of review Exam before when it was at the Edinburgh Film Festival and Jimmy Mystery was on. It was a strange thing because Jimmy Mystery came on the programme and he hadn't seen the film yet. You remember that? I'd seen it at the Edinburgh Film Festival and he hadn't seen it. So it's written, produced, and I think written, directed, and I think produced as well by Stuart Hazeldine. It's made for a very short amount of money, made in a very sort of compact period of time. Jimmy Mystery was interviewed by Phil Williams yesterday. I'm sure you can still download or podcast that interview. So the story is, it's effectively like the Apprentice with more threat. A group of people, a disparate group of people, are put together in a room. They're told that they are sitting an exam for a job. They're told there's one question which they must answer. They mustn't talk to the guards. They mustn't talk to each other. Of course, they turn over the piece of paper and there's no question. They have to then figure out what the question is. So imagine something like Cube, or I suppose more recently Fermat's Room. I mean, not in the same. Fermat's Room was a quite extraordinary piece of work, and it's not quite up with that. But it's a film which is clearly a very good calling card for its writer and director. It's a demonstration that you can, if you have a good idea, make something work for a very small amount of money, and you can make a movie that will get a certain amount of attention. I suspect that its primary audience will end up being on DVD and TV, but that's not such a bad thing. It's got a solid cast, including Colin Salmon, Luke Mabley, as I said, Jimmy Mystery before. And it looks to me like its people have decided to do it because they thought it was a well-written piece. And the idea is it's one location, group of people, which is an idea which has been used time and time again by B-movies, but demonstrates once again why sometimes the best thing that can happen to people is that they can have no resources. Because when you're completely restricted, when you aren't given a whole lot of things to play with, when you're told that simply what you have to do is to make the story work for itself, you often stretch yourself more. There was, I think, a sense towards the end of it that it wasn't quite in control of all its material. And again, it isn't without flaws. But when you look at what it was made for, the conditions under which it was made, the idea works. It's it's set in the near future. I think it's near future. And I generally enjoyed it, and I was certainly engaged with it all the way through. And it is a demonstration that you do not need a massive amount of money to make something that is decent and entertaining.
In the last couple of moments, you've heard, and this was being hinted at earlier with the Sports Bulletin, Liverpool's match, their home game against Spurs at Anfield on Sunday, has been postponed. This is due to safety issues as a result of the weather. Liverpool have confirmed that in the last couple of minutes. So what would be our movie of the week?
Well, can I mention very quickly,
this could be the movie of the week?
No. There's a documentary as well called Mugabe and the White African, which you don't need to see in cinemas. I mean, I imagine it will be elsewhere as well, but by Andrew Thompson and Lucy Bailey, which is a documentary about a 75-year-old white Zimbabwean farmer fighting his eviction from the land under the land reforms. And it's an extraordinary piece of work. It is about legal corruption. It is about whether racism can be against white people. It has some really brutal footage in it of the result of farm invasions. It was a very, very gripping piece of work. If you get a chance, in whichever format, look out for Mugabe and the White African. As far as the movie of the week is concerned, for me, I think The Road is the movie of the week, because I think in terms of what it sets out to, the difficulty of what it was trying to do, and the fact that you haven't yet seen the end of it,
yes,
makes it the movie of the week.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
If that podcast wasn't enough, visit my Uncut blog at www.bbc.co.uk/Mark Kermode for video reviews, anecdotes, and the chance to let me know your opinions.